Thank you for listening to this podcast from KX93.5, Laguna's only FM. We invite you to listen to more music and talk on our grassroots nonprofit radio station in Laguna Beach, California, from anywhere in the world on KX93.5.com/listen or on our smartphone apps. But right now, here's that podcast from KX93.5.
And good morning, Laguna Beach, and welcome to Moody with Dr. Sage. I'm your host, Kim Sage, and I'm a clinical psychologist. And today I've got a wonderful guest named Rachel Doerr. Welcome, Rachel.
Hi, thank you.
Thanks for joining me. And so you're listening to Moody with Dr. Sage. It's a show that explores our moods, our minds, and our real lives every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. And we're going to talk about eating disorders today. Mm-hmm. So, Rachel, tell me what you do. So you're a clinical psychologist.
Yes.
Yes, and tell me about what you do.
So I have my doctorate degree in clinical psychology. I specialize in eating disorders. I am the program director for an outpatient facility here in Newport Beach. And we specialize in treating eating disorders as well as co-occurring conditions alongside the eating disorder. And I am in charge of running two service lines, partial hospitalization programming and intensive outpatient programming.
Wonderful. And tell me, what made you decide to want to work with eating disorders?
So when I was in graduate school, I did a rotation in eating disorders. I actually went to a residential facility, and I fell in love with the population, getting to work with them, seeing how their minds function, seeing how talented these folks are. I just thought it was really, really interesting, and then at the same time, very confusing for me, because I never really had experienced anything like this before in my previous training, and so I just thought it was very intellectually stimulating. And so I did my doctoral dissertation on internalized stigma with this population, and then ended up doing my postdoctoral residency at the same institution where I'd interned. And so I just kind of fell into a pattern here through just interests.
Okay. What does internalized stigma mean for those listeners that don't know what that means?
Yes. So essentially there's prejudice in society towards certain mental illness in general, and then in specifically different types of mental illness. And the prejudice turns into stigma. Can you hear me better now?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. And so that stigma is then perceived by folks who have the illness, so eating disorders. And what happens is they begin to internalize that stigma. So they begin to believe those things are true about themselves that society sort of presses upon them. Like, oh, it's just a lifestyle. Oh, it's under your control. Oh, you're just doing it for attention, that kind of thing. And the prejudice and the stigma comes from a lack of understanding and also a fear. Mm-hmm. But those who have that illness then internalize it and believe it to be true, and it actually makes it harder for them to recover, and it exacerbates the illness.
That makes sense. I was thinking, and then if you're going to seek treatment, you're not likely to if you're sort of buying into the fact that, oh, maybe I am just doing this for attention, or you're not even trusting yourself about what's really going on and what your struggles are.
Exactly. It can be a really shameful experience for people, mm-hmm. and really it shouldn't be.
Yeah, I agree. So let's talk about exactly what is an eating disorder.
So an eating disorder is actually, at the surface, yes, it's all about eating and food. But underneath it all, it's actually more about emotion. It has very little to do with food, numbers, calories, weight, body image, that kind of thing. It's all about disorders of emotion and somebody's inability to tolerate emotion, regulate emotion, difficulties expressing emotion or perceiving emotion. And so they then develop a set of coping skills to deal with that emotion, to either tamp it down or distract themselves from it or maybe avoid it altogether. And so the eating disorder is a result of that inability or unwillingness or fear of experiencing emotion. And there are different kinds of eating disorders that present, and they have their own clinical syndromes and symptoms.
which I think is important. It's not just about weight or about food. I think that people who don't understand the underlying disorder is about some sort of emotional dysregulation, some inability to communicate their needs or wants or those types of things, right?
Exactly. Right. Yes.
So without going into great detail, can you just walk our listeners through sort of varying degrees or differences between eating disorders and what those look like?
Sure, sure. So when people think of an eating disorder, they usually think of anorexia nervosa. And that's just somebody who is significantly below their ideal body weight. So based on their genetics, where they're supposed to be, they're significantly below that, and they have an intense fear of weight gain. So they restrict the amount of food that they eat to maintain this this underweight.
Okay.
So that's anorexia nervosa. Bulimia nervosa, we're usually seeing people at or above their ideal body weight. But there's also a fear of weight gain. The difference in terms of symptoms is that somebody with bulimia nervosa is going to be engaging in binge episodes, which is where you eat what we would typically consider more than a normal amount of food in a short period of time, followed by some sort of compensatory behavior. It could be throwing up. It could be exercising. It could be taking laxatives, something like that. There is something called binge eating disorder, which is a newer diagnosis, but really, really important to acknowledge and talk about because it's actually the most prevalent eating disorder. If you're looking at rates of anorexia nervosa versus bulimia, binge eating disorder is more common than both of those previous diagnoses combined.
Wow. And why is that, do you think?
I think people are often overeating and not really understanding that one occurrence, but when it's a pattern, that's when it becomes maladaptive. And we're in a society where there is food that's very much a part of culture and very much available. And a lot of people do seek comfort in food. You think about soul food and
comfort food,
yes. and things like that, mm-hmm. Treats, rewarding yourself. You know, there's this general, mentality like, oh, I'm really sad. I'm going to go eat a pint of ice cream or whatever the case may be. I think we're sort of programmed as a society to equate food with comfort.
Definitely. I think that's rooted in our childhoods oftentimes, mm-hmm. rooted back into like my mom made cookies and it made me feel so good and I came home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, obviously there are lots of different ways that occurs, but
mm-hmm.
So let's say you're a person who binge eats.
Mm-hmm.
What is the difference between it being a problem and it being, you know, just something you do that isn't a great coping mechanism every now and then?
Mm-hmm. So honestly, the frequency and intensity. So if this is happening, you know, once or twice a week for, I would say, a period of 2 to 3 months, you're going to see significant weight gain, of course, and other medical abnormalities. It's going to throw your electrolytes off. It's going to throw your cholesterol off, that kind of thing. Too much sugar, of course, can put you at risk for developing diabetes. There's lots of medical complications associated with binge eating disorder, not to mention stress on the bones, things like that. And so if it's occurring with some sort of regularity to where it's impacting some area of functioning, then I would say it's probably something worth addressing.
Okay.
Versus just every once in a while. Right. I mean, look, we've got Thanksgiving coming up, and it is centered around binge eating.
Right.
Let's just say it.
Right.
That's what it's about.
It's planned binge eating.
It's planned binge eating.
Right, right. Yeah, and I think that you know, we are going to have to find some other ways to deal with that because obviously there's a relationship, too, between obesity and binge eating.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, and so that's where a lot of the stigma comes in for binge eating disorder. And so it's the most prevalent eating disorder diagnosis. However, it is significantly underrepresented in treatment centers and treatment facilities because there's a barrier to entry there because of the stigma. especially if you're somebody who's in a larger body, and maybe you even get to the point where you realize, okay, this is an issue. Maybe you've got some very savvy treatment providers who are saying, okay, you've got an issue. I'm going to send you over here. You're going to do an outpatient program or whatever the case may be. If you're sitting there in a larger body, you're like, I don't want to do that.
Right.
I don't want to go with all of these other people that probably look a lot different than me, and maybe they're underweight and things like that. So there's a barrier there. Also, I think a lot of times people in the medical field, especially primary care physicians, aren't really primed to be looking for disordered eating. That's not their training. But they're saying, look, you know, you're obese. Here are your medical complications. You're at risk for this, that, and the other. You need to lose weight. Let's look at our options, gastric bypass or medical weight loss facility, things like that. The issue is that, yes, you could do that. That's a temporary fix because you're not dealing with the underlying emotions. And binge eating is an emotion-driven behavior.
Right. That's an excellent point, right? Because I think you're right. People go into a doctor's office to deal with the physical symptoms mm-hmm. of being overweight. Mm-hmm. But oftentimes, we're just like we pass out pills for those things. Mm-hmm. We're not treating the root cause. Mm-hmm. And so therefore it's probably going to happen again and again and again, which is, I think, I mean, look at dieting and that whole mm-hmm. failure historically in terms of, it doesn't work,
It doesn't work. No, when you diet, it's a temporary fix, but usually the weight comes back and then some.
Right. Exactly. All right. So the other thing I want to talk about, and this is not technically a clinical diagnosis, is what we call orthorexia.
I knew it.
I know, because I feel like living in Laguna and Newport, I feel like this is how we mask.
Totally.
We mask our eating disorders.
Oh, yeah.
So let's talk about that.
So orthorexia is actually, like you said, I'm so grateful that you're acknowledging this is not a clinical diagnosis, but it is a term that we're using in the field, and also lay people are using to describe this phenomenon where there is clearly disordered eating to the point where it's impairing somebody cognitively and probably medically, but it has more to do with clean eating. Clean eating meaning no gluten, no dairy. Most people that have this symptom set are avid exercisers. They care a lot about their health. They eat only organic. They don't eat processed foods. And these people are functioning and eating in a really small world. And it's probably not, I imagine, a very fun or exciting or dynamic one. But they're getting by. They're skating by because there are all these different messages in the media about what you should be eating and not eating, and here are the possible consequences of this, that, and the other. And so they it's justified, and they're eating clean and only eating this, and that, and the other for health reasons,
right.
not for weight control or anything like that.
Right. So how do you differentiate? How would you decide between, okay, I'm just really focused on eating well and I'm really loving the organic sort of way of being in the world versus this becomes a problem?
When it's too rigid, when your daily routine is so compulsive and rigid to where you have an inability to tolerate any sort of deviation. For example, somebody might generally choose to lead a healthy lifestyle, and that may include eating organic. Perhaps they notice that they feel very lethargic after eating carbs, so maybe they limit carbs, but maybe they're functioning normally, and if they want to go out to dinner and they want a slice of apple pie for dessert, they're going to do it. Okay. Versus somebody who just absolutely says no, and that's not a possibility, and that's not going in my mouth.
Okay. So I like that word. It's the rigidity of
mm-hmm.
it, right? There's
very
no
rigid.
Room for error. There's no room for flexibility, mm-hmm. which we want to be able to, go through the river of life, sort of bumping from back and forth and not being super rigid. Has
love
to be
that.
One way.
Yeah, I love that.
So, yeah, I like that. All right. So I think the other thing that's really important is there's a very high, what we call co-occurrence, mm-hmm. which means also occurring, issue around anxiety and depression as they are related to eating disorders.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah. I'm smiling because I work a lot with young children and their families, and I describe this exactly in a really corny way. So I'm going to share it with you. I let the parents know, you know, the eating disorder is a big personality, but the eating disorder has two best friends. And one's name is anxiety and the other one's name is depression.
Awesome.
And the eating disorder brings their best friends everywhere. Mm-hmm. They all walk into my office holding hands and holding hands tightly.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can't just address one. We've got to address everybody and all of those things. And really, again, if you go back to conceptualizing eating disorders, they are a way to regulate emotions. And a lot of that has to do with anxiety. So anxiety and depression are kind of driving the eating disorder and also maintaining the eating disorder. We talk a lot, another analogy I use is whack-a-mole. So if we're addressing the eating disorder, we're going to see an increase in depression and anxiety symptoms because we're no longer using that set of coping skills to deal with the anxiety depression. And so that's why we've got to holistically treat the person and not the eating disorder.
Yeah, I think that's just absolutely fundamental, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, and I use whack-a-mole a lot too, which is so true with almost all mental health issues. If you're not looking at the whole picture, you might take care of one thing, but then up pops something
mm-hmm.
else, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of what pops up too is the idea of how eating disorders affect, you know, they affect your gastrointestinal system, your neurological system, your mm-hmm. endocrine system, right? I mean, the cardiovascular, there's mm-hmm. so many areas where they create damage.
Mm-hmm.
Can you just give us a little snippet of that?
Sure, yeah. And the one thing I want your listeners to walk away from, I want hopefully listeners to walk away with a variety of knowledge and facts, but some of these medical complications are reversible and some of them are not. And so I think that's really important to note. So we'll see things like tooth decay, osteopenia and osteoporosis. Both of those things are irreversible.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes amenorrhea, so women who aren't able to reproduce because they don't have their period. Their body is shutting down. It's in a state of semi-starvation. And so other things like we're seeing increase in stress hormones, which can have all kinds of complications,
mm-hmm.
As well as vital organs beginning to decrease in volume, especially the heart.
Wow.
And also the adipose tissue surrounding the organs gets used up by the body and converted to energy. So your organs essentially aren't protected. You're just walking around very, more fragile.
Wow, that's really scary.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really important to say. This is not just your classic, these things happen to the anorexic human being.
Mm-hmm.
These can happen across the board in different ways, obviously depending on the severity and the nature, but to all of the eating disorders we talked about today.
All of them,
right.
Including one we didn't talk about, which is ARFID.
Right.
Avoidant restrictive food intake disorder. And that, again, the etiology is a little bit different in terms of it has more to do with picky eating, aversion to texture or taste. A lot of times somebody maybe had a trauma around a certain food and then that generalized. And so, again, you're seeing a restriction of the amount of food that's consumed, but there's not that fear of weight gain. But you're still seeing that rigidity and you're still seeing the medical complications. For example, one I didn't mention that's super important to mention is electrolyte abnormalities. So your heart is electrical and it's running on electrical currents, and the electrical current is essentially the electrolytes in your body. So when those are off from either restricting or if you're purging, when those are off, you're at risk for arrhythmias for the heart or even worse. And so it's really, really scary to talk about and think about.
It is scary. And I will say I've had, and this is really an issue, I think, in this generation in terms of kids and picky eaters.
Mm-hmm.
I've had kids come to my house for a birthday party and say, hey, could you order my pizza without tomato sauce? Or, I mean, I've had so many kids that I only eat chicken fingers and mac and cheese. I mean, it really, it's very prevalent.
Uh-huh.
And so how do you differentiate between, okay, I have a picky eater who's super picky, and what you're describing as avoidant restrictive sort of behaviors?
So, and like I was a really picky eater growing up too, and still, you know, I have my preferences, and I think that's the difference, you know, having preferences, likes and dislikes versus absolutely physically I can't. Mm-hmm. With ARFID, we call it for short, you'll see, for example, choking, involuntary regurgitation. A lot of times people starting to eat food but then pocketing it, so throwing it in the side of the cheek, mm-hmm. Or over-chewing to the point where it just becomes like a big bolus and it's easier to swallow. But, of course, it really impacts, you know, your ability to eat a meal, right. Because it takes 10, 15 minutes to chew one bite of food.
And what would you say is the most frequent age range you see those behaviors in?
So we see this in the younger population, so a lot of the kiddos. And there's actually a lot of research currently showing that actually young boys are the ones that are perhaps more predisposed and to develop ARFID and presenting for treatment. So it's the younger kiddos, you know, the 6, 7, 8, 9, 10-year-old range.
Okay, good to know. I'm glad we talked about that, because mm-hmm. I think that's an important one for parents who want to, you know, it's becoming a problem. They're not really clear. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot of shame around that and admitting there's a problem and how do we deal with
that? Oh, he's just a picky eater.
Right, exactly.
Versus, this is a problem.
Right, exactly. Okay, and so I guess the other thing that comes up for me is, and this might sound a little general, but do you see a certain personality type or temperament?
Totally.
That might be more disposed to have an eating disorder?
Absolutely.
Okay, tell me.
So we're seeing, you know, the people pleaser, somebody who's high achieving. Most folks, in fact, all folks that have developed eating disorders, they're very smart. They're very, very smart, and they're very capable. In fact, you know, people with eating disorders experience emotion more intensely than you or I, and more frequently. And so it makes sense that they develop some coping skills to deal with that, because you can't be walking around bombarded with intense emotional experiences all day. Right. And so I also say folks with eating disorders are incredibly adaptive. Mm-hmm. Again, the perfectionistic personality style, sort of an anxious temperament. We see a lot of, you know, in doing a psychosocial history, we'll see a lot of folks who are presenting with eating disorders were sort of shy and slow to warm up in childhood, overly anxious to leave mom, that kind of thing.
Okay. So are there any parenting styles more associated with having children with eating disorders?
So in general, just a lack of emotional expression and a lack of affection in the home, I see as sort of a red flag if somebody is predisposed to develop an eating disorder. That certainly doesn't help. Essentially, if a child is growing up, so a child has no filter from age, I don't know, 0 to 6 years of age. There's no filter. So anything that happens in their life, in the world, at home, they internalize it. They don't.
It's about me.
It's about me. They don't question it.
Right.
And so if, you know, mom and dad don't ever express emotion, if one does and the other one doesn't validate it or ignores it or something like that, that kid internalizes it, and the message becomes emotions aren't expressed in this household, or I am weak if I express an emotion or ask for help, or that's dangerous or something like that. And so that's the core belief they have. Of course, it would make complete sense that they are then like, okay, how do I deal with this?
Right. I got to find something to do.
Got to figure this out.
Of course.
I got to make mom and dad happy.
Right. Yeah, I would say across the board, and that's not my specialty, but I mean, because I work with a lot of women, mm-hmm. and teenagers as well, I would say that I do find there is often a correlation between the type of parent, and mm-hmm. oftentimes it's mom, but not mm-hmm. always. It can be dad.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I don't want to, you know, us moms have enough guilt, but I do think it's kind of interesting, right? And I think in our world of mental health, we kind of do sort of see that more often.
And I think the aha moment for a lot of parents is when I do psychoeducation on parenting styles. And I borrow from Janet Treasure, of course, who does the animal parenting styles. And so we go over, you know, the kangaroo parenting style where the parent has their child in a pouch.
Mm-hmm.
At all times. And they're protecting them from everything. Right. And again, it's out of love. These parents are just doing the best they can. And they're operating out of fear sometimes and just out of extreme love and care. Mm-hmm. But what happens is, you know, if my mom is always protecting me from everything, the message I get is the world is not safe. Right. I'm not safe without mom. Mm-hmm. The world is dangerous. Mm-hmm. Same thing, you know, with the ostrich parenting style where you're sticking your head in the sand and you're not attending to your kid at all. Mm-hmm. And then there's the rhinoceros parenting style where you're really not attuned to your child at all and you're just charging through. Mm-hmm. When you see what you perceive to be an issue, you then charge through and you're like, all right, this is the answer. Here's what we're going to do. Here's how we're going to fix it. Mm-hmm. And so that kid then develops that core belief, oh, I can't do anything on my own. Mm-hmm. And I can't get any sort of resolution without a parent. Mm-hmm. I'm dependent.
Yeah, and, you know, as I sit here thinking, gosh, you know, I think parenting is the hardest job on the planet. It mm-hmm. really is, right? Mm-hmm. And we're not really taught how to do that.
There is no manual. I've looked.
Yeah, no. And even many of the books that are written, I find to be sort of, I don't know, it's like, if you just do it this way, mm-hmm. it's going to be all perfect. And, mm-hmm. you know, real parenting, every child you have is different and unique. And so what works with child A doesn't work with child B. You know, it really is hard to be mm-hmm. to be fair to parents and my own myself included. So none of this is about judging any of
no.
that, right? It's just saying, like, how do we get here and what do we do about it?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
We've got to make some changes within the family system. And I think that's the biggest misconception when we first start thinking about treatment. It's like, okay, here's my kid. Tell me when to pick her up and how long it's going to take.
Right. Just fix them. I'm not coming in.
Yeah.
Here you go. Yeah. And I think they're also scared. They're afraid
exactly.
they're going to be judged and, like, you know, and no one wants to feel bad about, especially being a parent, right? Doesn't feel good.
There's fear, of course. And then there's just a lack of, I mean, they don't understand. I mean, nobody is like, oh, hey, by the way, you're part of this. Because in the parents' eyes, they're like, well, no, I'm trying to support my child and get them better. I'm not part of this. Mm-hmm. And so it's sort of like, well, you are in a sort of background way, but it's not your fault.
Right.
It's nobody's fault.
And I think that brings up something that we know we're all talking so much about shame and Brene mm-hmm. Brown and
yes.
all those great things, which I just love so much. But I think that shame is a huge part of seeking treatment in terms of recovery, maintaining, mm-hmm. you know, your recovery, not just for the person who's there, but for the whole family system. It's
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So at my treatment facility, we have four main pillars that sort of underlie all of our interventions, all of our group therapy, and our individual sessions, even our psychoeducation. I can go into those at a later time, but one of them is shame resilience.
Right, absolutely. I think it's so important. And in the current culture, I mean, everything is about shame in terms of whether
yeah.
it's posting and about, mm-hmm. you know, how I see myself versus someone else. I never mm-hmm. feel good enough. I think we're flooded with it all the time. So
totally.
It's pretty difficult even when you have the tools,
mm-hmm.
right? Okay, so in terms of red flags for eating disorders, I know there are different types, but generally speaking, can
mm-hmm.
you say, if I'm listening and I go, you know what, this might be me or might be someone I love, what would be some of the top few things that you think are red flags with regard to eating disorders?
Sure. So, of course, there's the physical stuff, like if you see somebody's weight fluctuate dramatically or somebody's weight decrease in a short period of time or weight increases in a short period of time. If you are noticing perhaps you're a parent and your child used to love fruit and pie and they, you know, whatever the case may be, they used to love these things that they no longer like. And they say, no, I just don't like that anymore. And so you see sort of a restrictive mindset, not in terms of the amount of food necessarily off the bat, but the actual categories of food. If you see someone, again, just really rigid and really inflexible around food and eating, a lot of times we see food rituals like, you know, cutting your sandwich into fours, or breaking everything in half before eating it, using utensils to eat, you know, finger foods like pizza and burgers, things like that. Mm-hmm. Somebody who is maybe making a quick exit after a meal, or they disappear upstairs after a meal. Somebody who maybe, I mean, I could go on and on, but right. is all of a sudden talking about body image and more fixated on things like body image and preoccupied with recipes and going on different blogs, that kind of thing.
Okay. And I think that what's challenging about that is I think there's a certain type of person who these things, you know, you could spot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I found that especially with some of my adult female patients, they've become masterful, as mm-hmm. you said earlier, often very intelligent and have been doing this for a long time.
Yeah.
And I find that even their partners sort of second guess themselves about, mm-hmm. is this an eating disorder? Mm-hmm. And because we were talking before the show briefly, living in a beach culture, living in Southern California, where, you know, it's bikini season, really, to be honest, most mm-hmm. of the year, especially mm-hmm. now that we have, you know, no global warming. Mm-hmm. And so I think that the pressure creates a lot of this ideal belief system for women.
Mm-hmm.
And even as I look at, you know, older women with like menopause, things like naturally occurring things where you mm-hmm. normally gain weight.
Yeah.
Many women are not. They don't look like nothing's happened on the outside. But there's all these behaviors going on behind closed doors.
And so the average woman, right, we're talking about the average woman is probably about 5'4" and weighs probably 160 pounds, let's say. The average model is 5'11" and is weighing in at 117 pounds.
Wow.
And of course, in Southern California, we're very close to L.A. We're very close to a lot of, you know, all you guys have all these reality shows. I just moved here a year ago, okay. So I'm still learning
wait
about
a minute. What's this you guys
No,
think?
No. I mean, I'm slowly being indoctrinated into the culture, and I love it here. But, you know, as an outsider kind of coming in, I'm like, man, they have all the reality TV in the world. They're right close to L.A. You, like, live on a beach. People are walking around with barefoot, you know, bikinis, that kind of thing. I imagine all of that stuff bleeds into the culture
trickles
even down here.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
I read a study recently. This is sad. 89% of 10-year-olds are scared of getting fat.
That's just terrifying.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you know what? I'm glad you brought that up, because the issue I have is I think some of us who are aware are so many parents are so afraid to talk about eating at all because mm-hmm. they're so afraid that if I say, hey, maybe, you know, that's not healthy or that's a lot of pizza to my 10-year-old daughter, mm-hmm. I'm going to be introducing an eating disorder.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this is something that we aren't talking enough about, how to talk to our children, especially obviously this happens to boys and girls. So I do not want to stereotype that.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that it's become this thing where we don't know how to talk about it. So what's your advice for parents in that regard?
So I have this memory of my mom actually, one time we went to McDonald's, I was in high school, and we were talking and I got a McFlurry with Oreos and M&Ms and I was feeling it and I was so happy. And I asked her like, so can I eat this way forever? And you know, what would happen if I did and that kind of thing. And she, you know, she talked to me about, You can have whatever you want, you know. I want you to have what you feel is going to nourish your body. She was like, and I want to show you something. And she, we ate the burger. She had me eat my burger and leave a bite. And she said, I'm showing you that you can leave a bite because I want you to know that you're in control.
Wow.
You're in control of what you eat. The food doesn't control you. But you are worthy of food. You deserve food. You deserve nourishment, and you deserve to feel treated.
Mm-hmm. That's a great story. I think that's really helpful because I do believe that many of us don't know how to talk about it anymore,
mm-hmm.
right? And
mm-hmm.
if we're in the field, okay, that's one thing. But I think the average person is not in the mental health profession, right?
Mm-hmm.
So learning that you have control, that it also impacts how you feel about yourself and your body. It's not about the food.
Talking about it.
Right.
Talking. Now I'm like thinking about my mom all the time. And I remember one time when I was a kid, I was like, Mom, why does my stomach stick out like this? What, you know, what's this about? And what she did, she pulled up her shirt and she goes, look, mine does too.
Oh.
She goes, those are your intestines.
That's awesome.
And I was like, oh.
Yeah.
You know, and then I remember reading or, you know, then going to school and learning about the intestines and how they're like you know, how many feet of that. I'm like, oh, that makes sense why my tummy sticks out. Knowledge is power.
Right.
We can't be afraid to talk about this stuff. And one of the things I'm totally going to acknowledge is how close my mom and I were and still are. And so it made those conversations really easy. Mm-hmm. Whereas you think back to these parenting styles that I was, you know, we were talking about, or the closeness or lack thereof, mm-hmm. Emotions are what bring us close together. Being vulnerable, that's what bonds us. And so if that's not happening in the home, you're not going to feel safe and free to ask mom these ridiculous questions.
Right. And then you're going to have your peers and or social media, mm-hmm. or other types of media being sort of the place you're going to. Which mm-hmm. you were saying before, if the average model is 117 pounds, not really an appropriate understanding of mm-hmm. of real life in terms of health and weight.
And right. I think that we, as parents, I'm not a parent at all, but I work with a lot of parents, and I have parents. So I know what parenting is, and I think a lot of times it's just a lack of awareness about how something I say might impact my kid. Mm-hmm. Like yesterday, I was sitting at a cafe waiting for takeout. I was sitting next to a woman and her child, and I might be, hypervigilant to hearing, certain things that, of course, I'm like swiveling my head. I'm like, what? What's going on? Don't say that. But she said to her child, how many of those are you going to eat? Or how many of those have you had? Or something like that. And of course, I look over and I'm like, what's going on? And I'm like about to interject and be like, she can have as many of those as she wants.
Right.
And of course, it came from, curiosity. She was, I think, being a little bit playful. Mm-hmm. But for a child, who knows how they could interpret that? And so I also think it's really important to, of course, you can be playful and you can say, oh my God, you've had 4 Oreos already. Right. But also say, and that's okay. And I'm glad you're treating yourself.
Right. And that's what's hard is, I think, because, human beings are so multidimensional. Those comments with one child could combine with the family, combine with genetics, combine with all kinds of things. Maybe a history of trauma mm-hmm. could plant a seed. Mm-hmm. Whereas with another person, maybe even the similar things, but doesn't. So mm-hmm. it really is, I think, yes, we can cluster certain histories and behaviors, mm-hmm. but it's also just one of those things where we're all so different. We all respond so differently, too, mm-hmm. right?
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. No two kids are... I think a lot about being hardwired. I think that's a nice way to talk about the brain, and because a lot of it is heritability, right? So temperaments, personality traits, things like that, mm-hmm. We inherit from our parents. And so sort of think about, okay, you're hardwired to feel your emotions more frequently, or you're hardwired mm-hmm. To cope a certain way. But your twin brother might not be. And I do have a twin brother.
Do you?
Yeah. And we're alike in a lot of ways, and we're not alike in right. some ways.
Right. Oh, cool. That's awesome. Speaking of that, I'm glad you said brother, because I don't think we talk enough about eating disorders with boys and men.
Mm-hmm.
So what are your thoughts and what can you share about that?
So you're right. And so across the board, that's something, it's underdiagnosed in the male population, I think, a lot. And I believe that has to do with the shame and the stigma. If you're a wrestler and you are purging after you eat dinner the day before your meet so that you can be in a certain weight class, for a while that was considered normal and okay.
Right.
But what we know now is it's not. Mm-hmm. However, that athlete... isn't necessarily going to come forward and say, I need help. I have an eating disorder, especially when we have these preconceived notions in society about what an eating disorder is and all of the stigma associated with it. Oh, you're superficial. Oh, you're just doing it to look a certain way, that kind of thing. But yeah, it happens a lot in males, specifically athletes who need to essentially have control over their weight. So wrestling is the one that comes to mind, because that's one where you literally have to be in a certain weight class. Mm-hmm. Also, we see a lot of disordered eating in folks in the transgendered population. And again, a lot of that has to do with the emotion piece as well as the conformity piece, like how is my body supposed to look? And I want it to look this certain way, and I'm dying for it to look a certain way, mm-hmm. because for folks who are transgendered, a lot of them, there's they're like, I was born female, but really I'm a male.
Right.
And every time I walk into a female public bathroom, I feel like I'm in the wrong bathroom. Mm-hmm. And how do I cope with that? And how do I make my body look more male and vice versa? How, as a male, how do I make my body look more feminine?
Mm-hmm. And what about in the gay community? What is the prevalence of eating disorders or disordered eating in that community versus the straight male community?
We see an increase. There tends to be more. We're seeing more of more diagnoses. And again, is it because it's more prevalent there, or is it because those folks are more tapped into mental health and mental health resources and things like that? Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. But we are seeing that, yes, there is a slightly higher occurrence of diagnoses among the gay community.
That makes sense. I also think that for a lot of men and boys who are not necessarily into sports, when they're feeling anxiety and depression, they don't eat,
mm-hmm.
right? And this happens more than I even realized.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't talk about that. This mm-hmm. is like all of us. When we're feeling stressed or anxious, we stop eating.
Mm-hmm.
But it can become a coping pattern mm-hmm. for those with sort of chronic issues in that regard. Have you seen much of that?
Yeah. And on the converse, a lot of people, when they're feeling stressed, they eat,
right.
again, for comfort.
Right.
And so it's not just one way. But yes, and oftentimes, for example, like we'll see the onset of an eating disorder is usually for a woman around the time that they're hitting puberty. And that makes a lot of sense because for a lot of girls, that's actually a trauma. Mm. And so they're not eating on purpose to like maintain this childlike body. They're eating in response to an influx of hormones that is creating a lot of stress, and you're feeling this stress, mm-hmm. And so you've got this serotonin swirling around in your brain. And
right.
so for folks with anorexia, for example, restricting actually decreases that serotonin and actually makes them feel less anxious.
Mm-hmm.
But if everybody knew that, we could really put a dent in some of these false statements and the stigma around eating disorders,
yeah.
because that's what it's about. It's about decreasing stress. It's about tolerating emotions and the lack of ability to be able to lean into feeling stressed or whatever the case may be.
And I think that's so important, because if you just focus on the fact that you're restricting eating, let's say, mm-hmm. as opposed to saying, hey, you're really struggling
mm-hmm.
and you're just trying to find a way to deal with it,
mm-hmm.
right? And I think that does remove the shame, too. We're all struggling with how to deal with the influx of things we have to face every
mm-hmm.
day.
Mm-hmm.
It's just we all deal with it differently.
Yes.
And sometimes it becomes a problem and sometimes it doesn't.
You're reacting to a chemical imbalance
right.
in the brain.
Right.
And it's no different than reaching for medication.
Right.
Which is a lot more accepted in our society.
Absolutely. Yeah, just take this and we'll mm-hmm. just solve the problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
All right, so in terms of how these types of disordered eating patterns and behaviors and emotional occurrences as a result, how do they impact family members? And I think a lot of helplessness occurs in those, because you can't control what someone else is doing.
Mm-mm.
And the resistance is often extremely high
mm-hmm.
to treatment, at least in my experience.
Oh, yeah.
So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I notice a lot that when a family comes in with a child who's the identified sick person, mm-hmm. The life revolves. The world revolves around this child and their meal times and supervising, food prep and supervising eating and supporting them after the meal. And, oh, we can't go here because blah, blah, blah. And we can't go to this place because they have the calories on the menu and mm-hmm. it's too difficult for her. And so it really creates a lot of discord within the family system. Can you imagine being a sibling?
Right.
And your life is impacted too. We can't go here. We can't go there. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's all about her. This is her special food. Nobody can touch it. Mm-hmm. If you do, oh no, you're going to see her flip out. There's a lot of tension in the home. And like you mentioned, a lack of communication around it.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I'll work with families and the parents are adamant about keeping the eating disorder a secret from the rest of the siblings.
Mm.
And, wow. You know, my first thing is, you think they don't know?
Exactly.
So what are we doing when we are not labeling it? And that's perpetuating the shame. And that's actually giving more power to the eating disorder. Whereas if we just label it, discuss it, and talk about it as, yes, this is happening. It is no different than having asthma or diabetes, mm-hmm. or, having a broken wrist. It's a condition. It requires treatment. And it's possible to recover. Mm-hmm. That doesn't feel so scary to me.
I agree. But I think it's sort of insidious in the way it starts, right? Mm-hmm. And so it sort of creeps up on you as a parent or as mm-hmm. a sibling, or whatever. So that by the time you reach your center, the mm-hmm. Center for Discovery, which I'd like for you to talk about.
Sure.
It's often at a pretty high level of what's gone on. It's affected the person. We call uh-huh. the identified patient. It's uh-huh. affected the family and the siblings, friends. So tell us, when someone comes to see you mm-hmm. And about your center and mm-hmm. What you guys do.
So when somebody comes to see me, there are different, stages of change, when we're talking about somebody and their readiness to make a change and readiness to receive treatment and make changes, et cetera, et cetera. So the first thing that I do, of course, is assess where are you? Mm-hmm. Where are you in that stages of change? Because that is going to dramatically impact the how I conceptualize the case, the level of care that's recommended, and the kind of interventions that are implemented. We really try and customize care, and in fact, that's something we really pride ourselves on, is customizing care to meet the client where they're at. And I hate ending sentences with a preposition like that, but that's something that's generally said in our field, so I'm going to say it.
No, I think it's appropriate. So but what does that mean, mm-hmm. meet the client where they're at? Mm-hmm. What does that mean?
It means rolling with the resistance. So we'll use a lot of motivational interviewing techniques by just sort of asking them and being curious about, so why are you here? How has this impacted, this? How has this impacted that? What are your values? What are your goals in life? Okay, what are the values and goals of the eating disorder? And then let's put those up and let's look at them and let's compare. And let's see, do these things align or do they not? Mm-hmm. For example, somebody who wants to be a pro athlete, for example, and that's something that's really, really important to them. But at the same time, they have been suspended from the cross country team and they are losing their hair, mm-hmm. And they get really winded after a flight of steps. Mm-hmm. So that's something that's happening for you. That does not align with your long-term goals, which is being a pro athlete. So what do you want to do? I'm not saying you have to give up the eating disorder. I will never, ever say that. All I say is, what are you willing to do differently? Okay. What small change are you willing to make?
So how often are people coming in really ready to change versus being brought by a parent, by a loved one, maybe a therapist has made a referral? Mm-hmm. Talk to me about that.
More often than you would think. Because again, like you said, by the time folks are referred into my program, they've probably tried to do some work at the outpatient level of care and they haven't been successful, or they were receiving treatment at a higher level of care, so a hospital or a residential treatment center. And so they've already done a lot of that work and motivation to change is really high. And so they're just stepping down to my program to, generalize that to their activities of daily living and slowly integrate back into their life. And so they are really motivated to maintain the change and the progress they've already made. So I would say most often people are quite motivated.
So what do you do if you have someone who it's clearly a problem, mm-hmm. but they will not accept it and they're not going to the treatment center? Mm-hmm. What do people do?
So motivation can come at any time. That motivation is not a prerequisite for treatment. It's nice when it happens that way. It makes my job really, really easy. However, you don't need to be motivated to change to agree to start thinking about doing some things differently. And so what do we do when somebody has a problem but they're not ready to address it? We sit there with them. We meet them where they are, and we continue to maybe help them acknowledge moments in life where, again, the eating disorder got in the way again, or acknowledge the fact that, okay, things are getting worse, not better. And essentially they'll get to a point more or less, whether in treatment or outside of treatment, where they say, okay, enough.
Right.
I'm not living anymore. A lot of times by the times people are living, but not really living.
Right.
They're surviving. And when they leave our treatment center, they're thriving. And we get to talk about how different those two things are, surviving versus thriving. You were meant to thrive.
Right. And on that note, that's a great point. I think all the purpose of all of this is to living your life in a way that is fulfilling and where you can have some contentment and not to be in these rigid patterns we discussed earlier, where you're just, fighting to get through each day.
Mm-hmm.
Because, life is difficult. We want to develop healthy coping mechanisms.
Yeah.
Right? So on that note, thank you so much
joining
us. Yes. Tell us how people can find you and where you're located and your phone number and all that good stuff.
So my facility is located in Newport Beach. We have over 20 locations across the nation, a ton concentrated in California and Southern California, as well as residential treatment centers. And so I would say the best thing to do is, if you're considering, do I have an eating disorder? Does my loved one have an eating disorder? Go to our website, www.centerfordiscovery.com. We offer a few different treatment service lines. So we treat substance abuse. We treat primary mental health issues like anxiety, depression, trauma, things like that. And then, of course, we also treat eating disorders. And that's where I live.
Okay.
So click on the eating disorders link. And there are all kinds of resources. You can take a free quiz to see, is this, more or less, is this something that needs treatment, or is this kind of just like, I'm okay.
Okay.
You can do an online assessment. You can call our admissions department and do a phone assessment, or you can come in and do a live assessment with me, which is my favorite.
Awesome.
And so I also want to share my admissions information with you guys.
Okay.
If you just call 949-514-8018, you'll get to speak with an admissions coordinator, or you can reach me personally at my facility at 949-387-0889.
Wonderful.
Sure.
Thank you so much, Rachel Doerr, for joining us today. I really appreciate it. You are you have a wealth of information about eating disorders and about what people can do to sort of begin to change their lives. So thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Yeah. And on that note, you're listening to Moody with Dr. Sage. I'm your host, Dr. Kim Sage. I'm a clinical psychologist, and I'm here, generally speaking, every Sunday morning, live at 8 a.m., and please remember, everything you heard today is meant to serve for informational purposes only, and that if you are in need of mental health treatment, please seek help. Thank you so much, Laguna Beach, and all of our listeners around I guess really everywhere, because you can hear us online at any time or via podcast. Thanks so much. Have a beautiful day.